Let's conduct a little musical experiment. Listen to the Chopin Nocturne and see if you feel a difference between two snippets of the same passage played by the same pianist. Here's the first one. Now the second. Again, number one. Number two. You can feel the difference, right? Number one conveys more emotion. Here to explain why, Daniel Levitin. You remember Daniel. He's been on the program before. He was a successful studio engineer, a musician who turned academic to study the neuroscience of music at McGill University, where he's now the James McGill Professor of Psychology and heads the Laboratory for Music Perception, Cognition, and Expertise. He was on our program to talk about his best-selling book, This Is Your Brain on Music. Daniel, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me back, Robin.
We're going to hear more examples of different ways of approaching Chopin's Nocturne. But before we do, tell us about something you are now calling expressivity.
Well, one of the things that's interested me for a long time is why it is that performances can vary in the way they make us feel when the musicians are playing the same piece. I mean, there's, of course, this great community of people who used to follow the Grateful Dead around or Phish to hear them play their repertoire because they varied. From night to night and from performance to performance. They might even be playing the exact same notes, but there's something slightly different. And what is that? And, of course, we see it in classical music, too, which is the inspiration for the study that we're talking about today.
And you began that study after you heard a live performance of this piece of classical music. Let's listen. Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 27, stirring, but you left a performance feeling what?
I left a performance several years ago feeling flat, and I kept thinking Mozart wrote these beautiful notes, but why is it that I'm not being moved by them? And the answer I came up with was, well, there's something that this pianist isn't doing that other pianists I've heard do so well. But that particular day, I felt that there was something missing, and I wondered if we could answer that question in the laboratory.
So if you could briefly tell us, because now we get into the science and there's a lot of it, just briefly tell us what you and a colleague did to try to sort this out.
We had a concert pianist come into the laboratory and, as you heard, play several Chopin pieces as he normally would to an audience. Now, the interesting thing about the mechanics of the piano, that is the physics of the instrument, is that unlike the voice or the violin where you can change the pitch and you can have glissandos and swooping in and out of notes, when you hit a C, it plays exactly C.
Yeah.
You can't play it slightly sharper, slightly flat. And really the only control the pianist has is how hard to hit the note, when to press the key, when to release it, and where to put the pedal. And all of those parameters are recorded by the Yamaha Disclavier, a kind of robot piano with a computer built into it. So we recorded Tom Plant, a professional pianist, playing these Chopin nocturnes. And, of course, what professional pianists do is they add expression by deviating from the regular. They don't play every eighth note exactly the same length. Mm. They play some longer and some shorter and some louder and some softer.
As we're going to hear, we have a few more examples of Chopin's nocturnes. This is Opus 32, number 1. So first of all, tell us what you've set up for us here.
Well, so after the pianist came in, our Yamaha disc clavier kept track of all the notes that he played and all his deviations from perfect metronomic performance. And we stripped away all that variability. So we had a computer-generated, perfectly robotic, mechanical performance. Then we thought, you know, the 100% version, maybe that's an arbitrary maximum. What if he had been super expressive? What if he had had a shot of cappuccino before playing, or he had just had his heart broken? Would he play it any differently? So using extrapolation, we created more expressive variation in the performance than was actually there. We wrote a computer program to give us 125% expressivity and 150% expressivity. So we now have a continuum of versions running from 0 to 150%. And people come into the lab, Robin, and they listen to these different sounds in random order. And they have no idea what we did. We didn't tell them. We just play them these different things. And we ask them to tell us, on a scale of 1 to 100, how expressive is this to you, or how emotional is it?
Well, let's listen to all three. The very first one is the expressive. Let's listen to that, the original performance. Now let's listen to the mechanical version. This is everything stripped away. My old piano recitals.
Yeah, it sounds something like a kid playing, doesn't it? Because kids don't know about expressivity yet.
Yeah, right. And now let's listen to the one that's been manipulated with a computer where you raise the expressivity quotient, this to 125%. So it should be very expressive. Let's listen. We're speaking with Daniel Levitin, author of This Is Your Brain on Music, about the results of his new research into something he's calling expressivity. And when we come back, we'll hear how his study subjects, musicians and non-musicians alike, ranked the different versions of music. Let's listen again to the expressive one. This is the absolute original human performance. Back in a minute, here and now. And Dan, before the break, we were playing snippets of Chopin's Nocturne, Opus 32, number 1. This is the music you played for your study subjects, who then ranked the emotional content of different versions. Let's listen again to the original version, the human version. And now a version in which, through computer manipulation, Dan raised the expressivity quotient 125%. And Dan Levitin, I'm betting that even though you added so much expressivity through this computer manipulation to that second version, your subjects could hear it, that they would still pick the first one, the human one, as having the most emotion.
Well, you're right. People could hear the difference, and they didn't particularly like the 125. They didn't feel more expression or more emotion in it. In fact, it sort of gets to a point where there's too much, and people think there's something funny going on.
Yeah.
The 150% version was rated as less expressive than the 100%.
There's something so ineffable about this. It reminds me of, you know, I can be listening to a piece, and it's going along, and it's opening my heart, opening my heart, opening my heart, and then one false note, and my heart shuts.
But, yeah.
Yeah, and it happens, too, with audio tape that we work with. You know, you are maybe cutting it, and you've got it where it's, you know, you're feeling something, and then there's a moment where you know you haven't done something right because the feeling goes away. Maybe you can tell people now why that feeling goes away?
I think, Robin, it's useful to think of music as a form of emotional communication. And we all know from relationships that we're in that when you're trying to explain something that's important to you and that's meaningful, if you don't get the words right and you don't get the timing and the cadence right, the message is really misunderstood. It's the same with musical notes. it's up to the musician to interpret those notes in a way that is meaningful and convincing. One wrong note or one note that's overplayed and you feel manipulated, perhaps.
But I understand that you think that this knowledge that you've gained from this study can help people, for instance, teach. But can you teach this? Isn't this something great musicians already know? They already know. Wow, I need to go to a minor note there, or I need to sustain that more than the composer might have on the sheet of music, because I just know it in my gut.
I think that great musicians have intuitions about this, but it's years and years of training and a lot of modeling. By modeling, I mean a great musician may listen to other great musicians and performances that move him or her and think, how did that musician do that and how can I do that? And one could imagine with a disclavier or suitable technology, maybe an iPhone app, a student could compare their performance to a great master and see what they're doing and how that's different than what the master's doing. And they can come closer and closer to the master. Not that you ultimately want to imitate somebody, but as a way of developing your own style, you want to study what's worked in the past.
Well, but you mentioned the disclavier and you mentioned apps, and that reminds us that we are doing things so much more electronically. Computers with very precise, defined beats. I mean, I sit up and snap to attention whenever I hear a real drum, you know, on a song on the radio. And, you know, we might be losing this human element in music, which brings us to Stevie Wonder.
What I love about this Stevie Wonder track is this is Stevie playing the drums, and if you listen carefully, he's using his right hand to play the hi-hat. He's not just playing toot, 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 toot like a metronome. He's varying and mixing up the little beats. And it's that human variability that gives that drum part so much life and so much energy, and he's doing that throughout the entire tune. And the brain loves that. It loves the sense of change while still being constrained by the underlying tempo of the piece.
Well, but you talked to Stevie Wonder about expressivity and the difference it makes when you compare his early songs like Superstition, when he was using more of a human element, including himself on drums, and then other recordings when he switched to electronic drum machines. What does he say?
We had a very interesting conversation about this. He loves playing the drums, but it takes a long time to record drums and to get them set up properly in the studio. And at one point, when drum machine technology became available, he started using it. And it creates a great amount of precision and regularity to the piece. And the human ear tends to tune that stuff out after a while.
Yeah.
The ear is drawn to change. The brain's a giant change detector. And so when we listen to latter Stevie Wonder music, although the songs are still great, of course, and the vocal performances are amazing, some of us, and I think Steve included, feel that the drum parts have become kind of secondary, unfortunately.
Did Stevie Wonder also tell you that he thought that maybe a decline in his record sales at about the time he switched to drum machines for songs like Part-Time Lover was maybe not a coincidence?
I think you're right. He did notice a decline in his album sales. It may have been coincidence. It might have been related to the use of drum machines. It's hard to know.
Well, but how do you, maybe still use drum machines because you have to, but incorporate some of the findings that you've made in your studies?
Well, so this is something that Donald Fagen of Steely Dan and Stevie Wonder have been doing for the last few years. They use drum machines because it allows them to play around at leisure in their own time. And then they go in and they move around the beats to make them more human-like, to make them less precise. Fagen spent 6 months on the drum part for one song for one of his solo albums, just for Kamakiriad, just moving hi-hat beats and snare drum beats around by a few thousandths of a second, barely perceptible, but to give it the feel of a live drummer.
It's fascinating. fascinating. We'll listen to a little bit of that as we go out. And Daniel Levitin, just tell me, you know, I know you had Bobby McFerrin come through your studio. What do other musicians tell you about your study?
Well, in the last couple of years, I've been very lucky because a number of musicians have come through the laboratory and talked with me about the work we're doing. Bobby McFerrin is one, Paul Simon, David Byrne, Sting. And I think they're really interested to see that science is able to confirm some of the intuitions they have, hard-won intuitions. David Byrne told me that every once in a while, he knows if he's not feeling any emotion, he can replicate it if he puts a certain little strain in his vocal cords. And he can make people think that he's feeling that emotion. And in the end, it makes him feel it. Yeah. There's a sort of full circle effect, right? And so I think that modeling, that is learning to mimic or master the techniques of people who came before us, is very effective at training musical emotion.
Fascinating. Daniel Levitin, he directs the Laboratory for Music Perception, Cognition, and Expertise at McGill University, is also author of This Is Your Brain on Music. To read his study on how musicians express emotion through music and see a video, go to our website, hearnow.org. Daniel, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Our producers include Lynn Manigan, Hitesh Hati, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Jill Ryan. Our interns, Alyssa Greenberg and Anna Miller. Our technical directors, Doug Sugertz. Chris Ballman is the managing editor. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week may bring here and now. With dancers, ladies,
funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.